Good afternoon. Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're in that glorious time of the year, right, Cindy?
Oh, yes. It's so exciting. Yay, grilling outside.
The days that you can survive the humidity and the mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I'm looking at my notes, and one of the things is dealing with insects. And that's not really something I normally have on my notes for the radio show, so that's kind of funny. You're the one that said it.
An important note.
You have to.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning of the idea. So what we're talking about is entertaining outside, cooking outside, being outside in the time of the year that is beautiful to be outside.
Mm-hmm.
And accepting.
Which we all love to do.
Accepting that one, you know, horrendous July day or something.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a couple of months of that coming up. So we thought we'd kind of go through the thought process.
Lay it out for the people.
The last segment of the program, we have an interview with Cindy's mentor.
I'm so excited to talk with him, Marcelo Vasquez.
An Argentine chef.
Yes.
Coming from a culture of cooking everything, including entire animals outside all the time.
Yeah. So. I mean, Marcelo was my chef that I worked for. And when I was in Charleston, South Carolina, his restaurant was called Morton's, named after the man that owned the inn, which was the Vendue Inn. Morton Needle owned the inn, so he had his name on the restaurant. But Marcelo and his wife Penny owned the restaurant actually and operated it. And I did my apprenticeship from culinary school there in 1986, and then upon graduation in 1987, I came back and was a sous chef. So I worked with him for several years, and eventually Hurricane Hugo came through in 1989, and Marcelo and Penny relocated their restaurant from Charleston to Knoxville, Tennessee, and asked me to be their chef. So that was my first chef's position. Marcelo and Penny ran the restaurant, were the restaurateurs, and everything working with him was just an absolutely amazing experience.
Did you guys ever cook any whole steer out on the street?
That's the whole thing. No, not out
Charleston.
On the street.
Come on.
But one of the great things—
Can you imagine? I mean, that's—
I will ask Marcelo to talk about it, but he would have employee parties for us, and we were a young group, and one of the first parties, we went out onto one of the islands near Charleston, and, I felt like I was in Argentina, quite frankly, and we got there, and he had been there for hours, setting up the grill, setting up the fires, starting the pig, and I won't go into it too much.
When we get to his interview at the last segment. So let's talk about logistics of outside.
Right. So you're the front of the house guy, and you're so good at this stuff. So I'll ask you. So if you were going to get started, let's say you're doing a party for, a good-sized group, how would you start to organize?
It's different outside, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time people are arriving, whether it's at your home or at a dining room, a private dining room that you've organized in a restaurant or a club or something like that, or a hotel, it's always the same thing. They come in, they don't know what to do. They do know they're there to eat and drink. If you make those two things obvious and easy for
sure,
them right away,
right.
If the quicker they get a glass of wine or whatever the cocktail of the day is or whatever it is that you have
or non-alcoholic beverage, just get them something to drink.
So once they have something in their hand and they know how to repeat that,
mm-hmm.
and once they begin to know what the steps are with food, it's a funny thing, but as a host, you can't just kind of put things out, and unless you give people a little bit of direction, you're never going to be able to have them follow a pattern that is a successful pattern. You know, that's kind of they'll come in and go exactly the other place that you didn't want them to go to yet.
Okay, so how do you
control
them?
Or they'll start on all the food that you—
How do you get them to do what you want them to do?
I think usually you want to lay out things in stages. Right? You're going to produce things in stages.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have, whether it's inside or outside, you just have other considerations like temperature and sanitation changes.
That's the biggest problem to me. As a chef, I worry so much about how do you keep everything cold.
And I'm going to bother you for a little bit of sanitation advice.
You betcha.
And that doesn't mean, that's the getting your trash picked up. That means keeping the food safe.
Right.
To eat outside. Because that's my big, If I'm invited to a barbecue, I'm just terrified. Like, can I eat that? Am I going to die?
You know, sure. Right.
You don't want to do that as a host. I would not recommend it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What I always do is think of scenarios. When they first come, what is it you want to happen? You want them to get a glass of rosé, a choice, and limit beverage options. You have a nice non-alcoholic option. You make it very easy to get to. You have a credenza or something outside, or a table set up with very easy to find ice and a scoop and a top for the ice bin. You have something laid out with whatever the punch is, let's say, that you have, with a bin with several bottles of cold rosé on ice, with two beers picked out, you know, and all ready to go, and glasses or jars or whatever for that. You know, that's make it like they walk up, boom, that's very easy and doesn't require service. And from there, if they turn around and they, what you want them to see when they turn around is where some food is.
Right, right.
And if let's say that you're going to serve a total of like eight things, take a few minutes and figure out logistically what are the things they're going to sit out longest, the safest, that are nice to have with, you know, what are the snacks that are basically the things that can sit out with those things for a couple of hours that you don't have to sweat being out there.
And that's the great thing about antipasta, because if you have olives and cheese and, you know, things like cured or smoked meats, those things can sit out for a little while.
As long as they're not in the sun, they're going to be fine.
Right. Well, yeah, and they have to be protected too. I love those. You know, you almost have to have the little netting
things. A
little
cover or a
lid.
Yeah,
and that's nice to be able to get. You can get those in a lot of different stores.
Yeah, I know that you can. Oh, there's a bunch, couple different places to order them online. These great big, almost looks like a top of a tray, like a rectangular something made out of netting.
Okay.
That weighs almost nothing, and you lift it up and you put it down. It's really kind
that's
of
great. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Easiest thing to capture a bird with. In
well,
the
I mean,
whole
you
world.
Can't. You can't.
Also, cover your salami.
Like you said, you don't want bugs on your food, obviously,
yeah.
And you need to protect it. Well, so, and really, you shouldn't be setting up in the sun. I mean, you need to be on a porch. You need to be under an overhang. I mean, somewhere that's in the shade, under a tree. I don't know, but I mean, you can't be in direct sunlight with your food. That's tough. I mean, maybe you have to be, but.
The other thing you want to figure out when people come in: do you want them to stand? Do you want them to? You know, what is the point of the event? What is the music that you've organized? What is the, are there games? Are there, you know, that I'm imagining it's some kind of a party where it's, you're sort of working off of your porch and there's a lawn, something going on with several games. And do you have some seating alongside of that for people to take a break from that?
Sure.
Or to sit down with a drink
and
have a conversation?
Yeah.
Do you have a couple of little tables? You know, how much seating do you want for that sort of reception time,
mm-hmm.
and how much do you want that reception to kind of like roll and build into what the rest of the event is? Let's say that you have that reception time and snacks set up, and the next scenario that you have is that you're going to have some kind of a buffet outside.
Right.
You know, the toughest thing with that is figuring out exactly how and when to produce and what quantities of things to produce.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to let your crowd kind of build up a little bit.
Right.
And you also have to be strategic about producing things that you have the apparatus to get done. If it's just grilling things and everything else is cold at room temp, it's pretty straightforward.
And the great thing about grilling outside is, you know, you're going right off the grill and hopefully right onto people's plates. They can line up and come over to you, or you can, you know, grill, have a cutting board on the side of your grill or on a table next to your grill. Go ahead and slice it, and people can kind of come up and help themselves, or you can go right onto a platter.
You just want to make it easy for them to mm-hmm. go. If they're going to Grillmaster Cindy, you know, I'm sure you have an apron that says that,
oh, mm-hmm.
right?
No.
Don't you? And
no,
a special
actually,
hat that goes with
actually,
that?
Actually, I don't.
It's like conductor's hat?
Right, no.
So
mm-hmm.
there you are at the grill with your conductor's hat and your Grillmaster Cindy apron.
Yes.
So they come up with their plate and they say, give me meat.
Right.
Or mm-hmm. beautiful tuna that's coming
and
off the grill.
And I have a bowl of chimichurri
or sausages
on the side
or whatever
of my
it might
grill
be.
As well. So they can put their chimichurri right on their grilled
meats. But you
want
to make it easier for them to turn around and go to the table with the big crunchy green salad.
Right.
And
which is a very good thing to have outside, because if you don't put perishable product in there, just a big green salad with, you know, simple vinaigrette or something will sit nicely if it's on ice.
The big bowl of like giardiniera that you made and just put in the fridge. You know, the sort of like a little pickled veg that you always see in Northern Italian cooking. That's mm-hmm. that's fun to have alongside a grilled piece of something.
That's perfect.
You know, any kind of quick pickles.
And you can pre-grill that, as you said, marinate it, pop it in the refrigerator, pull it out at the last moment.
You could have used that grill early on to grill off zucchini slices.
Right.
And lay them out with a little salad of Reggiano and basil and lemon and extra virgin. And boom, you have a little quick scenario of that kind of stuff. They can go right from Grillmaster Cindy to pick up the other things to their plate, whatever sauce. Grillmaster, what kind of sauce would you prepare for that flank steak, let's say?
Chimichurri,
okay.
For sure. So Marcelo can tell us all about that in the next segment.
What I should do is ask you for your chimichurri recipe and then ask him for his when
well,
he comes
I'm interested to hear what
hear
he
you
says
guys
now
fight it
because
out.
I haven't worked for him for a long time, and I'm curious to see if he still makes his chimichurri the way he did. We'll talk about chimichurri for sure.
So, but there's any number of cold sauces or room temperature sauces you might might have out for something.
And honestly,
like that.
I love extra virgin olive oil on a piece of meat. I mean, I often do that at home. If I come home, if I go home from work and I'm hungry, I might throw a steak on my grill and I'll eat just a tiny little bit of it and save it for the next day. And hopefully I have olives because I really like olives with beef. It's just, and lamb for that matter.
The crazy high tech thing that I taught my dad to do and to love with a piece of beef in particular coming off, or lamb coming off the grill, is to take really good olive oil, like one of the big Tuscan oils or big Sicilian oils. And first with a mortar and pestle or even just on a cutting board to mash up a whole lot of rosemary and put that in a bowl and then grind that a little bit with that fresh oil and a little bit of coarse sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
And then put that oil on the – let
it's
that
perfect.
Steep for a while. And forget the big pieces of rosemary, but put that oil on the steak. He's definitely addicted to that.
I was grilling out last weekend with a friend of mine in Frederick. He's a priest. His name is Hector. And – he is from Colombia, and he was making, oh my gosh, I forget what they're called, but he takes cornmeal from his country and mixes it with water and just a little bit of salt.
Tostones.
That's not what he called it.
No?
No, I cannot.
In Venezuela, the tostones.
No, that's not what he, well, anyway, so, but he just makes a little, like, pancake out of them, and he puts them directly on the grill. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, they are so good. It's the simplest thing in the world. I cannot.
Maybe arepa?
Yes, that's it, arepa. And and he, you know, it's going to get black marks on it. I mean, it goes directly on a clean, oiled down grill. Mm-hmm. And it's the greatest, like he made the best guacamole. And, you know, we've got all these grilled vegetables. So we go in the house and I brought lamb. So I brought lamb tenderloins and marinated it with the pomegranate molasses marinade, which is another like amazing thing to marinate lamb with. I don't think I'd marinate it with anything else. But the pomegranate molasses from Iran, you just mix it with a little bit of corn oil to loosen it up a little bit because it's pretty thick. And you can either pre-marinate.
A little sweet.
It is sweet. Oh, definitely. It's molasses. It's sweet. And in the form of that, it's very sweet. But you add salt and pepper. And you can, if it's a small piece of lamb, something that's going to cook quickly, you can pre-marinate it. Or if it's a bigger piece of lamb, it will burn because of the sugar content. So if you don't like that, you definitely want to just brush it with that marinade as it comes off the grill. Oh, my gosh. It's so good. But he and I did that. And we just had this whole table full of all kinds of fun food. We made small bits of everything. There were only three of us eating. And we had a ball. And I brought fresh buffalo milk mozzarella, and we grilled zucchini for that and had a good olive oil for it. And I put a little bit of saffron in that olive oil. So, I mean, there's just so many things you can do. And all this stuff is super healthy. It's easy. It doesn't have to be hard.
No. I mean, that's simple food, beautifully done. But if you make it easy for people to get to things, I think that's make it very intuitive and easy for people to get fed. I mean, that's the first thing out of the gate. You make it, you're going to have a plate of this, and then you know what? We're going to have a grill plate that comes up later on. You tell a guest that when they're coming into something, they know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Probably we're going to drink for the next 2 hours all the wines that Bob has. And then, and then we're going to eat everything he's grilling.
Well, that's it. Like you say, stages. It's cool. You know, you start off with whatever you might want to call it, antipasta or whatever. And then you go into this food that you didn't have to pre-cook, really. You're cooking it to order. People are walking up to you and getting it. And that just kind of makes your whole prep time easier, too.
Well, it's all the garnishes and relishes and whatnot that sauces
made,
that you've gotten done
right
ahead of time. That makes it easy to entertain.
And you just knock it out. Yeah, exactly.
When we come back on Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll get into a few more details on entertaining outside. Actually, talk about cooking outside and get into a few recipes that go along with that on Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And I think you're gonna tell me that I didn't deal with a couple of things that I was supposed to deal with.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about, you know, how do you handle weather issues? You know, how do you really plan for this party?
Pray.
And well, and other than that?
Well, the other thing, I mean, there's the question is not just how do you have a nice something, sort of a lawn party, but really what is the party that you're having? That's the question that I did not deal with, like a skirting political candidate. I think you're referencing, right? So I wasn't not trying to deal with it. I was just being forgetful. My apologies. So what is the party that you're having? Let's say you're having a more formal event. You're having a small birthday party, but you want to have seating and you want to have a weather guarantee of sorts. And so maybe you're renting tents and maybe you're stringing all kinds of lights up in the tents and maybe there are all kinds of branches up there with the lights, so you still feel like you're under the trees, but you're protected from any of the bad things that Mother Nature might throw at you during your outdoor event.
What about other decorating? Any ideas for that?
I think the thing is that people, they think about like decorating a table. When you're outside, it really is kind of like, how are you coming into the space? Is there a staircase that you're, like at my house, you're walking down a staircase. What do you see when you're walking down that staircase that's right in front of you, you know? How is the path laid out for you to get to where you're going? I think one of the nice things for a host is to think about taking people from parking on the street to actually an entirely different place. And I think there's an opportunity in changing someone's approach or attitude towards coming to the event that you're having.
Setting the scene.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe it's the little torches along the way. Please don't burn the neighborhood down. Or maybe... Or maybe it's strings of lights, and it's as simple as, for you know, that your 2-year-old's birthday party. It's as simple as balloons,
mm-hmm.
but it can be more than that. And having a little bit of fun with that is only going to make your guests kind of lighten their spirits before they even come into the event. And I think that's something that decorating the table, fun, easy. There's a million ways to do it. I think that people often let's say you're having that party under the tent where it's you have 6 different tables, they're big round tables, and you have groups of people, and maybe you have not place settings for everybody, but you want to decorate the tables. The one thing I'd say is if you want people to talk to each other, if you decorate in the center of the table with something that's great big, that goes high, it may look great in a photograph with no people in it, but you won't take a photograph of people talking to each other in it because their eyesight back and forth is blocked.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do something that's relatively low. I think that's something that, and if you're doing a tent, I'd always say that the something you do on the table and the something you do up in the tent, they should connect somehow.
Sure.
So that you really have, if you manage to do something where the up in the tent, the tent post and what's on the tabletop all connect in concept, then you really have created a little space, a little environment just out of the air with that, mm-hmm. with that tent.
I think one of the other things is if your guests are bringing food, how do you plan? You know, I think people have to think about, how do I plan for that? Do you tell them, you know, do you kind of make a list and say, hey, you know, Alice, will you bring this? And John, will you bring this? And fill in the gaps. And how do you deal with the fact that they walk in the door with something that needs to be heated and you already have your oven full of food? And I think you have to really be organized when people are bringing food.
If you're going to let it be a wild card.
Oh, you're...
Then
that's tough.
Then God bless you.
Yeah, that's tough. I think you really have to tell, kind of say, hey, this is your category. You're bringing dessert.
So give me an idea. I know I need 2 people to bring fruit desserts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give me an idea what you think about you doing so I can make sure we have a really nicely coordinated menu set up.
I agree.
But I want you to do something that you're good at, that you're excited about.
That you want to do.
And that you want to do.
Sure. That's what I say to my guests.
But do you want to do a pastry? Do you want to do something as a snack? Do you want to just, you know, and that's...
Right. And then you just sort of fill in the categories with everybody, basically.
If it's part of that first scenario, when people are showing up and someone's bringing something that's meant to be a snack or an antipasti or something,
mm-hmm.
don't let that be the person that always shows up 30 minutes late for every party.
Right. Well, and also as a guest, I think you need to be thoughtful about what you bring. I mean, I think it's a little bit on the guest to think, okay, I know my friend, he only has, you know, 1 oven, and I really don't want to put them in a situation where they have to take this out of what I'm bringing and put it in one of their own dishes. You know, kind of bring it ready to, not kind of, bring it ready to go. Maybe bring your own, you know, maybe put it on something that's disposable so then the host doesn't have to deal with washing your thing and getting it back to you at the end. And also bringing, you know, disposable silverware or service pieces, you know, so that, or something, you know, it's not a big deal for you to walk over, wash your own service pieces and put them in your bag and go home. And then the other thing is wine. You know, what if people are in charge of bringing wine and, you know,
I think you deal with that the same way that you deal with
the food, right? You know, this is your category. You're responsible for this, and thank you so much. You're awesome for.
You
want to
bring
something.
Wine? That's awesome. You want to bring champagne or some kind of a light red? That's going
to
be great.
And it's already got to be at the temperature, right? It's got to be at the temperature that it needs to be served at.
Well,
too.
The other thing is don't be silly and expect your refrigerator to get everything done. I mean,
right,
that's
scary.
What do a couple of decent sized coolers cost?
That's what you need outside.
I know that for me doing things at home, I have any number of square or rectangular boxes that I'll put prepared foods in that I have ready to go, or backups for things on a table, and they go in a cooler. And literally, you can put that cooler, like if you have the tablecloth on that table,
yeah, that's good.
You literally just tuck the cooler underneath there.
I like that, yes.
And if you want to restock things on your buffet, you go.
And it's even cooler if the cooler is on wheels, because you can just roll it out of there.
You roll it right out.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I have one that has a sliding top, so you slide open the top.
Ooh, that's cool. Oh, I like that.
You slide open the top, and it's like a shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And you pull the ones out that you need.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think the other thing is to just have big tubs or whatever it is, wash tubs or coolers, or like in the restaurant business, of course, we end up bringing Lexans full of ice. And that way, if somebody brings a couple of, you know, sixes of beer or whatever, they can pop it right into the ice there. Or if you're serving beer, the guests can help themselves.
Well, that's the thing.
Have the bottle opener
make it
right
easy,
there.
Mm-hmm. Make it easy for them to be successful.
Exactly.
If your guests are going to show up with, if you know that someone's going to show up with beer, they have to have a landing place for it.
Yes.
If someone's going to show up with a blueberry crisp, they have to have a landing place for it. And if you know that they're bringing something they really wish they could heat up, you've got to figure out how in your plan to carve 10 minutes out of oven time.
Right.
At the end of things.
But if you know ahead of time, then you'll be fine with it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I know your grandmother used to do this, and I don't know, maybe everybody does this, and this isn't exactly words of wisdom, but if you do know that people are bringing things and you have your table laid out for where you just put a little piece
Post-its,
of paper.
Baby.
Yeah, Post-its down with, you know, Joan casserole or whatever on it, and that way Joan walks in and she puts her casserole right there.
I think that is super.
I mean, your grandmother did that. That's so smart. And she also would put it in service pieces, so she had all of her service pieces figured out ahead of time.
The service piece for it, the plates you're going to plate it on, I mean, whatever it might be. It's funny. I just literally just did this for a charity dinner, you know, with hundreds
at
of pieces
house.
Of china at my house with hundreds of pieces of china and big service pieces. And it makes it easy. You review everything once, and there's still tags on everything.
Yes.
And so then the front of the house, you know, the service staff
exactly.
know what's
Somebody
going on.
Somebody that's helping you knows what to do.
You know, there are five people working in my house that have never been in my house that don't know what any of this stuff is called.
Mm-hmm.
They know that right now is the fish plate. That's
right.
Perfect. That's
right.
All they need to know.
Well, and that's the other thing you have to consider. Do you need help? You know, maybe you can't have help, but if you can, you know, really guiding, you know, having the service team come in and really educating them, telling them, you know, what is what and what you expect of them, and making them successful will make your party go much better.
Well, I talked about just literally taking a piece of paper and figuring out those scenarios. I mean, it's always a timeline for me. You take the first 45 minutes, I want Luke and all his pals for his birthday party. I want them to come in, and I want them to drink beer and eat these four snacks and play lawn cricket or something, you know,
yes.
and hopefully nobody goes to the hospital.
Gosh.
Okay. After that 45-minute period, we're going to move into the tent that we have decorated with all the different clown faces and all the, you know, whatever Luke wants for his birthday. You know, and then we do all the grilled things that go with that, and they come to the buffet line and they see the grill master and they move on. And
yeah, perfect.
You know, and then at dessert time, we're actually going to go in the house for dessert, and we're going to have cake, and that's laid out on the table, and that's already laid out with all the plates and all that kind of business. And the reality is that at some point they're going to be in your house anyway. Make sure that you know that. It also you may have torrential rain right in the middle of the event. You know, that's the other thing you have to think about.
Yes.
I don't want to be silly, but mark where your restroom is.
Yes. That's, yeah, guests are uncomfortable.
Make it easy.
Where is it? Right. No, I
make
think
it easy. They shouldn't be asking the grill master, where's the potty?
What about, I know you like to make sangria. I think that is a great drink for a lot of people.
That's an easy one. I mean, that's with that cooler idea, you literally can just have one pitcher after another lined up of all the garnishes, and the bottle of wine that finishes that sangria, cold and ready to go. You pull those garnishes out of the ice, pull the wine out, you add the wine to it, you have the pitcher, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's That honestly, if you're doing a casual something and you want to not do wine and keep it or make it very cost-effective wine and just fun, you could be doing, you know, you could be doing each one of those tables that you have set up. A pitcher of sangria goes down on each one of those tables. And that's if you have
that's
all the
easy.
Garnishes ready to go and on all the different pitchers. And it's not like you don't have to have, you know, crazy antique ceramic, you know, pitchers from the south of Spain to put sangria in. It can be very straightforward glass pieces or that you can see all the fruit and all that kind of business anyway. But that's a great choice.
Now that we know how to serve sangria, how about a recipe, Tony?
I was waiting for you to say rexcopy. that's when you but to ask for one drink recipe too many.
Yes, exactly.
I think the concept on sangria is very straightforward. I think a lot of times people get confused and think that they've got all kinds of syrups and all kinds of crazy stuff, and you need to make a potion essentially with booze and fruit. And a very classical way to do that would be, say, brandy, nice brand, Spanish brandy, California brandy, simple French brandy, not something that's aged a tremendously long time. You don't want the woodsy flavor. But that's a good thing to have in there. Cointreau is nice to have in there. Triple sec, also known as Cointreau on a budget, is reasonable to have in there. Mm-hmm. There's any number of things. You could. I wouldn't maybe use tequila. I wouldn't use some spirit that's been aged a really long time in wood. Things that have a really, really big outlier flavor that's going to be sort of confusing with wine and fruit, because that's what you, the three things you're going to do are make the potion, have fruit garnishes ready to go to finish it with, and have the wine that you're going to serve it with. The wine that you're going to pour into all that business is honestly the most important thing. You want it to connect to whatever the fruit is. If it's fruit that's in the season, let's say it's right now, and it's sweet cherries and blueberries.
That would be so
pretty
good.
Fun season.
Yeah, that would be great.
Maybe it's in a couple of weeks, and it's white peaches and the first apricots.
That would be really
good.
So let's
say it's that.
That's
it's white peaches and the first apricots.
Mm-hmm.
So the potion that you make needs to connect with that and the wine that you're going to serve with. For me, inexpensive sparkling wine that's really good, maybe Cava or Conca would be great to use there. Sparkling wine from Vouvray. I like to use sparkling wine from Vouvray for this kind of thing, honestly, because Chenin Blanc has acidity that's really strong and citrusy. And if you don't have fruit that has a lot of acidity, it's nice to have that. You can always fortify those apricots and peaches and the white peaches with a little bit of, you know, lemon. And their peel. The peel gives a little bit of perfume too in the oil. What you don't want is a whole lot of the pith and all that sort of business in there. Use the fillets from the lemon, and go ahead and add those to your fruit business, and add some of the peel that you use. Just use the peeler to take off. But the white pith that's just going to make things bitter and discolor in the drink glasses. So there's your fruit business. You're going to honestly build your glasses with those. So you have 40 people coming. Need to have enough fruit ready to go for 40 people to build those
that's
in the glasses, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need probably, your potion needs to be about 20% of the volume of it. So if you're building your glasses with fruit and ice, then, you know, what do you need for 40 people for that? It's, you literally sit down with a calculator and figure it out. My guess is you'll probably need about a liter and a quarter, something like that, of your potion. So whatever the alcohol it is, that the fruit that you're going to use and the alcohol that you've chosen, those are the things that you want to mix and macerate. And that's usually like an overnight thing. And you may season that. Maybe you're seasoning that with a cinnamon stick. Maybe you're seasoning that with fresh rosemary or lavender.
Yeah, that would be great.
Maybe you're doing it with tropical fruit in the wintertime and you're using a wine that's a little bit sweeter, like a Riesling or a Pinot Gris. You could be using lots of citrus and pineapple and cilantro. And cilantro I wouldn't do the day before. I would do that just to finish. But something to make it refreshing.
Cilantro is a more delicate herb. So
exactly.
Do it,
And those are the things. Your potion is something that you're going to strain off the potion into the glasses. So there's your glass. It has the ice. It has the fruit. Then the potion is sort of strained on top of that business and trickles to the bottom. And then you add your cava. You know, and then I would literally pour the cava so it sparkled for the guest when they're getting it, you know?
Yeah, I like the idea of having the cava in there.
And that's fun and refreshing and ends up being
really refreshing.
Probably a little stronger. It's probably as strong as fortified wine, so the ice is important. If you're serving 6 ounces of this, where two-thirds of it is wine and one-third of it is stronger spirit.
Yeah, I've heard that can catch up with you pretty quickly because it's so good
you're essentially having the alcohol of 9 or 10 ounces of wine.
Yeah, so
in the glass,
careful drinking
you're thinking it's fruity and it's nice and easy, and and then you're going to be asking for recipes. So, but that's the basic method of making sangria, and the recipe can be something that you adapt based on the fruit that's in the season or what you're excited to find, and the wine that you're going to use.
Wash the fruit before you put it in anything.
Oh,
and
goodness,
the herbs.
Yes.
I mean, please wash and drain.
And dry.
And
unless you want to add water to it.
Obviously, you're not putting those cherries in there with the pits in. That would be a bad surprise
for
your
guests. That'd be a pretty good surprise for your
guests. Yeah, you're going to have to pit those.
The other thing I would say is that you can use almost any kind of, the fruitier and younger the red wine is, the better it's going to be in that kind of
situation.
Do you
have a specific suggestion for that? Or? I feel like I used Levier Ferrum when I did my sangria a couple of years ago.
Mostly Grenache and Syrah, and that's an easy one.
Mm-hmm.
Tempranillo is a really good one because even if your fruit doesn't have a lot of acid, Tempranillo, especially a young one, will. And if you get it where it's not a lot of, it will have some natural tannin, but not too much. The tannin, the sort of chalky business, you don't want too much of that, I don't believe, in this kind of an application. Monastrell is a very good grape to do that with. That's Monastrell is Spanish for Mourvèdre, the French version. But they're mostly, you're going to find Monastrell from Jumilla and kind of like southeast of Spain. And a pretty big, ripe, bold, happy fruit, dark color. Primitivo from the south of Italy, one of the relatives of Zinfandel, will do well. Zinfandel.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's like young, fruity versions of those kinds of things. And if it's whites, again, I don't think I want anything with a whole lot of wood. Some big oaky Chardonnay doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So it's something that's pretty fresh.
Okay.
Is what you're after.
And then we need some backyard wine suggestions.
Yeah.
Top five backyard wines by Tony
Foreman.
Top five. Top five.
I think you need bubbles. You need white. You need rosé. You need a lighter red. You need a bigger red.
Okay.
Right?
Good categories.
And you probably don't need to spend a fortune. So I'm not going to give you one. If I give you one specific producer's X, it probably is going to be gone, or the vintage will have changed, or whatever, and I will have given you misinformation. But I can give you a concept. In the sparkling, I think that you want the sparkling Vouvray can be a very good category. Conca, as opposed to Cava, qualitatively is a very good category. And those are for sparkling that's kind of inexpensive. I would look for that. There's also a sparkling that's a little bit sweet that's probably really popular for a broad audience from France called Clairet de Die. And there are only a few imported into the U.S. that are quite good. In whites, Middle European varietals, I love in that kind of situation. Silvaner, Grüneveltliner, Riesling, if you want something a little sweet. Kerner, K-E-R-N-E-R, that's a little bit fruitier than some of the others. Some of these things from the Alto Adige in Italy or Austria, Alsace, the Müller-Thurgau, another grape. These alcohol is not so high. They're very good, very cold, very clean, long on the palate, and deal with salt well. And no wood in really any of those things. Fruity red, Primitivo, like I said. Primitivo cold, really fun. Young Sangiovese, like a Rosa de Montalcino, or very, very, very fun in that kind of situation. Bigger red, I wouldn't go bigger than a Chianti Classico. 2011 is a good year in Chianti Classico as well, by the way. And that's a lot of what's out and around the market. And those, price-wise, they're not crazy. You don't need a single cru. And that's very, very good grilled meat wine.
And we probably should mention an Argentine wine since we were speaking to Marcelo.
The sleeper in Argentina, because the world has over-popularized Malbec, so the average quality of Malbec has kind of gone down because it's everywhere at the moment. A grape from Lombardia that went to Argentina with a lot of Italian immigrants was Bonarda. And Bonarda is a medium-weight red, pretty punchy, a little bit like Dolcetto from the north, the west of Italy. Bonarda, if you can find it, or Bonarda blended with Malbec or sometimes blended with Cabernet, super tasty, price is reasonable, nice, a little bit cool, really nice for backyard stuff.
Any producers you can suggest? Because Argentines, I mean, I know you weren't going to be specific, but with Argentina, it might be helpful.
The Bonarda's pretty much only old vines and old school producers. You know, so okay. I think that's
That's one
where
varietals.
I would just say look for that varietal.
That would be fun to check out.
That would be fun to drink.
And that. Yes, all of it. I want to grill like Marcello right now.
When we come back in our next segment on Former Wolf on Food and Wine, we're speaking to Marcello Vasquez, a mentor of Cindy's and a native Argentine who is going to give us a lot of outdoor cooking tips, Argentine style. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we have a mentor of yours,
yes.
Someone who's very important to you. And with today's topic, which is entertaining outside and cooking outside, someone who is from a culture of cooking outside. Do you want to introduce?
Marcello, this is my chef, Marcello Vasquez. And he is from Argentina and has been living in the United States for how many years now, Marcello?
Oh, almost 40.
Mm. So Argentina is famous for their grilling techniques, and I remember very vividly the parties that you would give for us when I worked for you in Charleston. And I was wondering if you could tell people the traditional way of grilling in Argentina and how you used to start the fire and marinate the pigs and all the wonderful things you would cook for us.
Well, you remember that I drove the pig, no?
Yes.
Basically, you know, in Argentina, we cook with fire, it's the ancestral way of cooking. And we have what you call a parrilla, which is the grill, which has evolved from a simple cross, you know, of wood, where you hang the meat and then you light a fire way far from it, and you let the heat and the wind envelop the meat. It has evolved into a brick structure with a place to make the fire, which is normally wood, not coal, and then another place to put the grill, and the grill is raised up and down to regulate the heat, because we cook with very little heat in Argentina. We don't use flame or anything like that. And that's the way we do what we call the asado. I don't know if this answers your question or not.
Absolutely. How early do you start the fires so that the embers are ready to go?
Depends in which process you are using, but always you need to start the fire in order to have embers. That's why you light the fire apart from the grill, and then you pick the embers and just shovel them under the meat, and then you regulate the heat by raising or lowering the grill.
Okay. And making chimichurri, is that your ideal marinade for?
Well, we don't marinate meats. What we just do is we use the chimichurri as a relish. We just brush it on top of the meat after we have cooked it. Some people use it as marinade, but the traditional product is not, you know. Now, chimichurri is, you know, there is a very funny story about it. You know, it's a corruption of Jimmy Curry. Jimmy Curry was an Irish worker in the railroad in Argentina, and he invented that sauce.
Okay, that's interesting.
That's crazy.
I didn't know that.
I always thought that was an appropriated. I knew that there were a number of Vasquez that came from Spain very early in Argentina, and I always thought that sauce was an adaptation of the persillade that they would make in País Vasco.
Yeah. That's the story I told you is common mm-hmm. knowledge in Argentina. I don't know, you know.
So it's Irish sauce.
The names of the stuff of the dishes through the world. No, sometimes you cannot pinpoint the origin.
Of course, can you?
But it makes a nice story.
It does make a good story, Marcelo. can you share your recipe for chimichurri, please?
Well, basically, it's you just mince, it's parsley based. It means a lot of parsley, some garlic, and vinegar, and just a bit of oil. That's the basic chimichurri. Through the years, and the people who have put their finger on the pie there, they.
Sounds very unsanitary.
Well, they use herbs like thyme and oregano and stuff like that. But your basic chimichurri is really water, oil, parsley, and garlic.
And no chilies?
No, no chili. No chili. They have a version with red pepper. The spicy one, but I cannot pronounce the name here because it's rude.
Oh, okay. My goodness.
Let's not have that on the radio.
Right?
No, we cannot have that on the radio.
So,
do you have any other suggestions for grilling techniques? Your thoughts on that?
Well, as far as I told you, we do it with very little fire, as opposed to when you ask a steak, they are fire cooked with flame.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to see flame, and we don't want to see smoke.
Okay.
So it's a very different way of cooking meat here, for instance, in Texas, where fire and smoke are
part of it.
We're a culture that's impatient.
Well, I don't know. It just depends, But and asado also is as an extension of the word is used in Argentina as you invite people to an asado, which means they are your close friends, and you eat through. Maybe 2-3 hours, You start with a little bit of sausage and a little bit of chicken, and then you progress into the red meats, and you usually end with lamb. And you don't use plates. Traditionally, you use bread, and you cut a slice of bread, and put on top of it the meat, and then you pick the meat and the bread with your teeth and with your knife, or it's a dagger really, very, very sharp, you cut without cutting the lips.
That would be nice.
And that's the way you eat it.
So it's a slightly manly meal, maybe 8 different meat sandwiches in a row.
Well,
without cutting the lips.
You don't much eat the meat, the bread.
The bread is the plate.
Yeah.
And Marcelo, about empanadas, what can you tell us about that?
Well, empanadas is basically an imported food because we in the Americas really have very, very little local food. Everything has been imported from the mm-hmm. from Europe, mm-hmm. which is from. Brought in by the immigrants. So empanadas is basically a Spanish or English or French. They all have different names of them. But, it's in Argentina, they differ a lot from province to province. In some provinces, they are made with a pastry that is very smooth. In other provinces, made with, a pastry which is very similar to a millefeuille. Mm-hmm. Some are fried, some are baked. and some are very, very full of fat. So when you eat it, you know, the fat goes down to your elbow.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah. But basically, there are a few types which are, you know, the filling is it's ground meat or cheese and onions and you know what else, you know, sometimes you know you have the Spanish empanadas made with fish, with tuna and mackerel.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes like that. But they put in every empanada, they always put some hard-boiled egg, which I don't like much.
Yeah, me either. One of the other things you used to do, Marcelo, and I was so shocked the first time you did it. You bought cheese from Argentina and sliced a big fat slice of it and put it on the grill.
Oh, that was provolone cheese.
That was so good.
But not the provolone we think of for a sandwich we get in the grocery store.
No, because the one you buy here, it will go through the grill.
Right.
basically, you have to get the provolone, which is, you know, woven very, you know when it's made, it's like mozzarella, but many more times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes that makes the casein hold together very, very hard, you know. And then you put it on, and then you season it with salt, pepper, oregano, and olive oil, and serve it.
So good.
That's an Argentine theme for my next cooking.
That's called provoleta, you know, in Argentina, because it's a smaller provolone. It's like a Milano salami, you know,
mm-hmm.
size. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Marcelo. One, for me, it's a joy to speak with you, and I thank you so much for everything you taught me. You are one of the best chefs I've ever known in my life. And I'm just a cook. You're a very, very, very good one, sir. And thank you so much for talking to Tony and I. It's absolutely been a treat, and all the best to you, sir.
No, it has been nice to talk to you too, Cindy, and I congratulate you on your success.
Thank you.
You deserve it.
Thank you, Marcelo. Thank you so much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Well, that was terrific to talk to. It was cool, honestly, silly to say it on the radio, but it was cool to watch your face talking to a mentor of yours.
Oh, I loved him. He influenced the beginning of my career so much, and he is just a naturally gifted chef and a brilliant man.
I like the idea of...
And he used to race cars, so of course I love him.
Race cars and a tasting menu of... meats eaten off your bread plate.
Awesome.
You cut with a very sharp knife without cutting your lips.
Well, you know.
Try not to cut the lips. That's all we have time for today on Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
If you would like to listen to previous broadcasts of Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine, please visit the WYPR website. You can download podcasts. If you want to reach us, you can reach us at foremanwolf@wypr.org. And thanks for listening to WYPR.